Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today we begin a four-day series on achieving something many people find elusive, a work-life balance. All over the world, most people have to work, but somehow people in other parts of the world seem more able to keep work at bay. They feel less guilty when they shut the door on work and open the door on their personal lives. Americans work longer hours, forego vacations, and with the advent of smartphones and computers, can always be on call. We're looking at all of that this week, at the many different aspects of work-life balance and the challenges we face in achieving it. And today, we begin by considering whether such a balance is even possible, and if so, how to make it happen. We're joined by Bridget Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab at New America. She was an award-winning journalist for The Washington Post, and she is the author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. She joins us from a studio in the remote accesses of Delray, Virginia. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Derek Thompson also joins us from the D.C. area. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. In 2013, he wrote about how work-life balance in America got so out of whack. And yet, despite that and his work at The Atlantic, he still has time to host the podcast Crazy Genius, tackling big questions about technology and culture, and to appear as a frequent contributor to CBS News and NPR's Here and Now. Thank you for being here as well.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, feel free. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So, Bridget, let me begin with you. I know you believe it's true that Americans have a greater problem with achieving a work-life balance than people in the rest of the world. So why is it? What's wrong with us?
It's a great question, and it's a good place to start, because we tend to think that there is something wrong with us or with me, or that there's some kind of personal failure, or if only I got up earlier, or if only I had more willpower, or if only I could change something, things would be better. And that's certainly the way I thought when I first began reporting and researching my book. And it really took me a long process to see it is not all you. It is not all up to the individual to figure out and fix, and it's not why we got here. We are making decisions that do make it worse, but we are all acting as part of this larger environment, and it's a much bigger picture. And I think it's important to have this really good sense of awareness, why we work long work hours, where that came from. It all started with changing economic structures, changing gender notions, and the sort of what we felt men and women could be and do, and where we still haven't really caught up with our the way that we're living, how workplaces really haven't changed to accommodate how people work and live, and how we really have a lack of public policy that helps people, helps families. We don't have, you mentioned childcare will be something you'll be talking about tomorrow. That's a huge problem for so many families. We don't have paid family medical leave. We don't have paid vacation days. We don't have paid sick days. So we have an entire system in public policy, in workplace culture, and in our own cultural attitudes that just add to this continual swirl.
Yeah, you said system there, and I was just going to bring, you've talked about policy and system and lack of policy and lack of systems that lead to all this, but in your book, you say that we work, Americans work, among the longest hours of any advanced economy, and we value busyness as a badge of honor. Where the heck does that come from?
Well, it's funny. I was talking to a leisure researcher, and he wrote an entire book to try to figure out why and how that happened. You know, in the mid 20th century, the view was we were becoming so productive that by the end of the century, we would be working 4 days a week, or we would retire in our 30s, and that didn't happen. And instead, everything has sort of sped up, and we can't seem to get ahead, and we're working harder and harder, and we're earning less and less. And part of that, when you look at long work hours, it is true. We work really long work hours. So that's for the professional class, those tend to be long work hours. But for you know, in the for hourly workers, they don't necessarily have long work hours, but because they have short work hours, they have to cobble together a whole bunch of different jobs, perhaps, just to try to make ends meet. So their hours are very different, but the stress is very similar in terms of that work-life conflict and trying to have that sense of security. And we have made busyness sort of the price of admission. We don't value leisure here in the United States. We kind of never have. We have sort of this, you know, Protestant work ethic has been part of what we've thought has made America great, so to speak. But really since about the 1980s, when you start seeing work trends and work hours really climb, again, particularly for the professional class, we began to value it and reward it financially and in the way we talk. And so now you've got people like Elon Musk tweeting, you know, you can't change the world in 40 hours a week, that you're somehow a loser if you work 9 to 5, that somehow always on work has become the way that you show that you are the ideal worker. And so if you are working 24/7 as this ideal worker, you don't have time for family and you don't have time for leisure. And that must be stupid and a waste of time.
So Derek Thompson is with us. He writes about this in the pages of The Atlantic and talks about it on various broadcasts and on his podcast. So is this a problem that will ultimately solve itself, Derek? And I ask because we've had several people on this program who have predicted that in 20 years, 30 years, there will be no jobs. And you have written a cover story for The Atlantic called A World Without Work. So will people in the not too distant future be looking back on this period in which we live now, where we don't take vacation, where busyness is a badge of honor, and look at it wistfully?
Yeah, let me talk about this issue through two buckets of solutions, and then I'm going to end by talking about automation, because I think that's a very interesting gloss to put on this. So I see this as a set of top-down factors and a set of bottom-up factors. So the top-down factors are the factors that are clearly policy. You know, most advanced countries give new parents paid leave. At the federal level, the U.S. guarantees no such thing. Most advanced countries ease the burden of parenthood with national policies. And in the U.S., public spending on child care, early education is near the bottom of international rankings. In a lot of countries in Europe, you have much higher rates of union membership, but private sector unions and public sector, frankly, have been in steep decline since the 1970s. So here you have a group of public policies that exist at the state or the federal level that I think are responsible for encouraging Americans to work more than they might want to. At the same time, though, as Bridget said, I think there's a set of bottom-up factors. You can think of them as sort of internalized attitudes about work, internalizing the sense that leisure is bad for you and work is edifying, internalizing the sense that from a young age you think that achievement equals greatness as a human, that achievement and making money and being thought of as successful is more important than having a family, more important than being a civic member of your community. And so the rat race that begins in middle school and continues through high school also continues when you join the law firm, you join the consulting agency, and you work and work and work thinking that life is just about ascending the mountain of acronyms from CFO to CMO to CEO, that is the purpose of life. And so that's an internalized value that can stem from public policy, but I also think is a little bit different than a policy. There's no law that says you must become a CEO. Now, you talked about automation. What is automation going to do? Well, on the one hand, you can think about this in the lens of, say, you know, John Maynard Keynes, the economist who in the 1930s said that by the time we were living in basically our age, 2019, we would have an abundance of leisure time. And the problem of human civilization wouldn't be how do we solve all these issues of science and productivity, but rather how do we manage the downtime? Well, obviously, that hasn't really come to pass. You know, working hours, especially for higher income people, have actually extended in the last 30 years rather than diminished. And I actually think that has a lot to do with a surprising effect of automation. Well, one thing that we know about the path of robots as they're eating jobs, the path of automation, is that it tends to automate routine-based work first. So manufacturing-style jobs, assembly-style jobs that are boring and drudgery. And it leaves in its wake jobs that are a little bit closer to what we might think of as allowing for a little bit of creativity and self-actualization. So in a weird way, you could argue, and I hope I make this clear, that as automation eats more and more of the jobs that we consider to be boring, it leaves jobs that are flexible enough that we can fill them with our dreams and hopes and identities, such that you could actually ironically have a world where greater automation leads to longer working weeks because you have a bunch of people competing to show each other, look, my job is perfect for me. I'm extremely successful in my job that I can work at for hours and hours and hours wherever I am. So in a weird way, I think that as certain white-collar jobs become more abundant in a heavily automated economy, workism, as I call it, this sort of religion of work that we've adopted here in the United States, could actually increase rather than decrease.
Because I was going to, as I listened to you talk, I was going to ask one of you, I'm not sure which one of you to ask, is this, if we were given more free time, given our work ethic, this Protestant work ethic that you've referred to, and this workism ideal, would we know what to do with it? Or would we flounder about because we are not being productive?
Well, you know, if I could go back to a point that Derek was making about automation, I think, on the one hand, that, it's this wonderful vision that we would have time and space for doing what work gave us a sense of meaning. You know, and honestly, sometimes, when you think about pure leisure, what the Greeks were talking about, leisure was sort of a sense of learning and that place where you could become most fully human. It was a scholarly kind of bent to it. And so when you think about sort of the best jobs, would really be what the Greeks would consider leisure, when you were kind of free from the drudgery and constraints of life, from the getting and doing of making money. So, how you would combine those sort of dream jobs with making money is still an open question. But I think a really important thing to think about in the future of automation is not everybody has those kinds of opportunities right now. And I think that's a huge question in future of work. What mm-hmm. about the retail workers and the cashiers who get automated out of jobs and, don't have education and are exhausted and don't have childcare and, can't afford to go to workplace training. And, that's not something that the government is investing in and has programs about. What about all the people who might be left behind? So I think that the question about time is an important one, but who's going to have access to that kind of time? And will that lead to greater inequality? I think those are also things that are really important to keep in mind.
Well, I don't know how it is in other countries, but I know that if you go to a cocktail party or a dinner party and you don't know some of the people there, within the first 3 minutes of a conversation, they're going to ask you, what do you do? Because in America, we are defined by what we do, what job we have. I know that's particular to men. It may be as well to women now as they've entered the workforce in greater numbers. If that's so important to us, how do we get over this hurdle? How do we balance work and life if who we are is defined by what we do?
Well, if I could jump in again,
sure.
Erik Erikson, the Harvard psychologist that I sort of I borrowed from him in the subtitle of my book. He talks about the richest and fullest lives. You know, when you look back at the end of your life, what gave you a sense of fulfillment and meaning? He said the richest and fullest lives have time for what he called the three great arenas of life. Work, having meaningful, purposeful work that gives you that sense of meaning and purpose in life. Love, time for connection with other people. We know from happiness studies that is how human beings are most happy, is when we are connected with other people. So time for that. That also means time for being connected to your neighbors and involved civically, but also time for play and leisure.
Bridget, I have to interrupt because we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the work-life balance that seems so elusive in most of our lives. It's the first day of a four-part, four-day series devoted to the various aspects of this. And this hour, we're talking to Bridget Schulte. She's the director of the Better Life Lab at New America and the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And Derek Thompson is here. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic who has written about this in the past and the host of the podcast Crazy Genius. You may also know him from his appearances on Here and Now. Americans, let me go back to something, Derek, you said a minute ago about policy, et cetera, and plans and laws that emanate from Congress and why we don't seem to have the same kind of attitude or policies that they have in other Western industrialized nations. Are these policies deliberate or are they benign? Are they being pushed by corporations for Congress to not have mandate paid leave, et cetera? Or are these just simply baked in from the work ethic that we as Americans all seem to share?
It's a great question. I unfortunately think the answer is extremely complicated. Let me simplify it by saying that I think the answer is best thought of not as existing entirely within our values or entirely within the interest of corporations, but rather exists along an historical spectrum and is very much involved in the United States skepticism towards socialism. That the U.S., unlike Europe, did not have socialist parties in the late 19th century, early 20th century that advocated for a lot of workers' rights. And a lot of what we're talking about are essentially workers' rights, you know, paid leave, protections for union membership, guaranteed health care. These are workers' rights, and they emerge from Europe's history of socialism. The United States spent the greater half of the 20th century fighting against the evil empire, the Soviet Union. And during that time, during a period where a lot of European countries sort of were building out or solidifying a welfare state that includes a lot of these policies, because we were engaged in a cold war against evil communists, we just didn't establish the same kind of policies within our government. I also did want to go back to something that you said. You asked a cheeky question. If we had the free time, what would we do with it?
Yeah.
There's an interesting way to answer that if you look at the history of house work. So if you think about the typical housewife at the beginning of the 20th century, she is living in a technology-free home. There's no microwave. There's no vacuum cleaner. There's no electricity, really. There's certainly no dishwasher or washing machine dryer. Over the next 50, 60 years, you essentially have the typical house sort of swallowing all these technologies. Suddenly you have, you know, a microwave and a dishwasher and a washing machine. And the amount of time that the average housewife was working during this period, during these 50 years, actually didn't change at all. It went up by an hour from 50 hours a week to 51 hours a week. And you're like, wait, how did all of this time-saving technology increase housework? And there's sort of two answers. One, and I know Bridget's written about this as well, so I'm interested in her take on the history too. One answer is that the patriarchy sort of enforced higher standards on housewives as the technology got better. So essentially, once you can mop the floor more efficiently, then standards for floor cleanliness suddenly skyrocket. Another answer is that we have this work and consume mentality, so that whatever free time we have, we just put into consumption. So obviously, microwaves make it easier for food to be made. That's just a simple fact. But what ended up happening is that housewives spent more time shopping for food because their husbands thought, well, if you can make the food in 30 seconds to 90 seconds, I want more kinds of dinner. So housewives spent more time shopping for different kinds of TV dinners. And so in many ways, there's social expectations we have that certain kinds of work should take X percent of the week. And as labor-saving technology increases, it ironically saves no labor and no time.
And isn't that precisely what is happening in the workplace with the advent of technology like smartphones and the internet and computers, which allow us to be connected to the office 24/7? We can, we are, therefore we should work.
Bingo. It's the Parkinson's law of work. Work expands to fill the time allotted. And employers have allotted, 40 to 50 hours of working time a week for full-time employees. And as a result, the work is going to expand to fill that time. And there's a certain expectation that, in my profession, in writing, it's a lot easier to publish something when you have a keyboard and access to the internet and you can put something on the internet in 5 seconds. That's a lot easier than it was in the 19th century to publish a newspaper. But guess what? Do I work, you know, just 5 hours a week? Absolutely not. Don't tell my boss that I do. You know, like, I work 40 to 50 hours a week and because I'm just writing more and publishing more and working the exact same number of hours potentially as my 19th century compatriot, even though the technology is better. Yeah. Absolutely. Expectations are rising commensurate to technological improvements.
Bridget, jump in there.
Yeah, so one thing that I really want to add here as well, you know, we talk about changing social expectations. I think it's a really important point here to make that we also began to change our expectations around mothers and motherhood at about the same time. So, you know, it's almost crazy making that once women entered the workforce en masse in the early 1970s, you know, and I think that that's important for people to realize there were two reasons for it, really. And one is that wages began to stagnate. So families needed that second earner in order to keep that same standard of living. I think people tend to think that it was all about the women's movement and choice. But for many families, having that second earner kept them from falling into poverty. So we need to think about that was a huge driver of women into the workplace, as well as the women's movement opening up opportunities for women and having education and choice. So once women entered the workforce en masse, what you started to see in about the 1980s was that time spent with children started to go up. And you think, how could that be possible? Mm. You know, there are wonderful time use researchers that looked and found that working mothers in the 90s were spending as much or more time with their children than stay-at-home mothers did in the 60s and 70s. And when you kind of dig into the data and you think, how could that even be possible? You see that women started to give up time for sleep and personal care and adult relationships, adult friendships. They were spending all of their leisure time with their children. A lot of that was driven by this sense of guilt and this sense that you had to be this super duper uber mother that you could, you know, bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan and, you know, be this amazing mother. So the standards for what we expected mothers to be and do started to ratchet up, and they've really gone out of control.
And in your book, you say that our overwork culture is leading to burnout, stress, sickness, disengagement, and that it perpetuates gender inequality. One of you writes about Denmark. I'm not sure which one of you, because I've read a lot of stuff over the weekend.
Oh, I did.
Okay. And in Denmark, evidently, household chores are pretty well shared by men and women, unlike in America, and they still have more free time. So explain that. Why are we still putting the burden of household chores and child care on women in America as opposed to the men?
Well, you know, this is where the overwork culture really plays a huge role, because if you expect the ideal worker to always be on, to either be present in the office or signaling presence by emailing at all hours to show your commitment, how on earth are you supposed to be able to have time for care and caregiving? So that stayed primarily the responsibility and the expectation that women will do that. So if you have an overwork culture, it's very difficult for women to be able to compete, advance, and succeed in that kind of culture. Mm. And Denmark is probably not even the best example. I went there because there was some really fascinating leisure research that mothers there had more pure leisure time than any other country that was studied. And when I went to try to figure out, well, why is that? It was all interrelated. They worked very intense but short work hours. They had a lot of public policy that supported families, subsidized childcare, paid family leave. You were the bad parent if you picked your kid up after 4:30. You know, for most parents, people are scrambling to get home at 6 or 6:30 for the childcare pickup. They had a completely different expectation about men and women. From a very early age, young boys are expected to babysit. They are taught to cook. Both men and women take home ec classes in the schools. So there's a much different expectation around gender and gender roles, but there's also a huge leisure culture. Everyone there takes catalog classes. You know, it's just part of the culture. You learn Italian or you get your hunting license. And you were asking about the American cocktail party. The first question is, what do you do in places that have a stronger leisure culture? It's much more, what do you do with your free time? Mm. You know, do you swim in the ocean in the morning, or what club do you belong to? What sport do you like? You know, what are you interested in learning in your life?
So Derek, we have in America this belief in the work ethic from a number of reasons. It's also because we believe, I think, if we work hard, we will get ahead. It's the Horatio Alger story writ large in our psyches, I guess. But we now live in an era where we are experiencing a declining middle class, in which wages for those not in upper management have been stagnant for 30 or 40 years, in which parents now worry if their children will live as well as they are living. So given all of those factors, do we still believe that story that if we work hard, we will get ahead, we will get what we deserve monetarily, we will get that promotion? And if we don't hold those values, if we don't believe that anymore, will we see a shift in attitudes at work?
It's a big, good question. I think that today's parents are more concerned than ever about the prospects of their children and are doing, it seems, at least looking at the time use data, more than ever to ensure that their children get ahead. You saw, as Bridget said, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, a rather sudden and dramatic rise in the amount of time that college-educated parents were spending with their teenagers, which tells me that this is a phenomenon where a lot of parents who valued college education and really wanted their son or daughter to get into a fantastic college so that would make their entire life, that's why they're raising their hours of intensive parenting. That tells me that they've absolutely internalized this idea that it's unbelievably necessary that their children above all succeed in this sort of classic meritocratic way. But that, I think, also forces us to put the onus on colleges themselves. I mean, I love the fact that I learned when reporting my piece about the future of automation and the idea of work, the idea that school comes from the Greek word for leisure, that we used to teach people to be free, and now we teach them to work. And in many ways, I think today's colleges have become factories of workism. This is where people go and learn that life is a rat race. Life is this meritocratic rat race, and you have to grab one of the top five spots. And that, I think, is a dangerous and frankly, psychologically pernicious idea.
Well, I could be wrong about this, too, but college, going to college, university, used to be a place to go to broaden your horizons, expand your mind, explore ideas that had nothing to do with work. And now you go to college because you want to get a good job.
Absolutely, yeah. College has become pre-professional. I mean, they've had to be. You know, colleges, when they were finishing schools for the aristocrats, then you didn't really have to learn anything because you were an aristocrat and you were probably going to get an aristocratic job no matter how you performed at Harvard. In fact, ironically enough, Horatio Alger himself, I think, flunked out of Harvard. So he didn't do particularly well in college, but his father was very rich, and so he got ahead that way. I do think that as more people go to college, college itself becomes more competitive, and the post-college world becomes more competitive because there's more people that are like you, more people that are highly educated. So I think that a lot of this has to do with internalized attitudes about how career success is the most important factor in the making of a person. And there are other countries, as Bridget said, that I think have done a better job at shifting the spotlight away from, you know, how successful are you, what are your acronyms, toward, are you a good father? Are you a good husband or wife? What is your hobby? What do you guys do during the summer? That those tend to be the questions that make a person. And here in the U.S., we have different questions.
Are we seeing a shift already? Because it seems to me that we heard during the Great Recession that younger people were looking at their parents who suddenly lost their houses or lost their jobs, and they had to shift their entire way of life because their income evaporated for a good long time, and thought, this is not the way to live. I want something different. And you're looking at Gen Zers and millennials demanding more out of their workplace. There was an article yesterday in the New York Times. The headline was, "Can I Work When I Want?" About millennials. And to older generations, that may look lazy, but the article demonstrates that these workers have a healthier attitude toward work and that work-life balance. But is that any more than just a pipe dream? Are workers, our employers, going to put up with that?
So, you know, I think it's really important at this point to point out that there have been surveys kind of longitudinal over the years that show that what the millennials say they want, which is more time for life, to have a better balance or harmony between work and life, it's not a new thought. Baby boomers wanted that. The earlier generations also wanted that, to have that sort of larger life, that sense of meaning, but also time to enjoy the fruits of your labor,
but I'm
not
a baby,
just labor.
But wait a minute, I'm a baby boomer. It would never have occurred to me to go into a first job or a second job or a third job or even this job and say, look, I need daily time for meditation or exercise. I want to be able to come in early or come in late and leave early. I want more, 2 weeks vacation. No. I start with 4 weeks of vacation. I would never have thought to do that. And that's what they're asking for.
Well, so I think but the important thing to think about is that you probably wanted it, but you didn't feel you could ask for it.
Yeah, right.
And so that's what's different. That's what's different.
Well, why do
they feel there is more of a sense of why not ask for it? And I think to go back to some of the, like Denmark or some of the other countries that Derek has talked about that have these policies, that have these different attitudes toward work and leisure, it's really important to point out they are about as productive per hour as the United States. We tend to think, well, we work really hard, and so that's what makes us amazing and that we're so productive. But we're really not. When you look at productivity per hour's worked, how good are each of those hours? We put in a lot of long hours, but in terms of that hourly productivity, France is about as productive as we are. And they've got, you know, most of these countries have 6 weeks of paid vacation a year and child care and paid family leave.
Let's talk about that, because when we talk about health care in America, and we've talked a lot about it, we've learned that we pay more for less in this country than people in other industrialized nations get. The same applies.
And we live shorter lives.
Yes,
and we're sicker.
The same seems to apply to our attitudes toward work. We work more, we get less paid leave, we take fewer vacation hours that we've earned. We've watched as retirement benefits and health care benefits have dwindled, and they cost us more, while the rest of the industrialized world gets free health care and better retirement benefits. Is this more than our ardent belief in the benefits of capitalism? And I asked a question. I have 30 seconds for the answer.
Well, I would just say, going back to Derek's point, it's not that healthcare is free in other countries. They've agreed to pool their resources.
Right.
And we've got such a fear of sort of socialism without recognizing that pooling our resources, it would be a great way to help all of us live better lives.
That's Bridget Schulte. She's here with Derek Thompson. We're talking about work-life balance, how to achieve it, how it got out of whack in this country. And we'll talk more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about work-life balance with Bridget Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab at New America and the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Derek Thompson also joins us. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, frequent contributor to Here and Now on NPR and to CBS News, and he hosts the podcast Crazy Genius. I want to talk about two conflicting statistics with you, Derek. If I've understood you correctly, you say that by some counts, Americans work much less than they used to. The average work year has shrunk by more than 200 hours. On the other hand, we hear a lot about the 1% and how much they make in comparison to the rest of us. But you report today that the richest 10% of married men have the longest average work week, which defies economic logic and economic history, because the rich have always worked less. So why are we talking about this if we're working 200 hours less per year, and why are the rich working more?
It's a great question. I mean, the most interesting things in life are paradoxes and things that are intention. So economic history dictates that the richer you are, the less you work. That has been true for individuals. It's been true for countries. The rich worked much, much less than the working class in, say, Industrial Revolution England and France and Europe. And rich countries tend to work less than poorer countries. So if you compared, you know, working hours in, you know, Sweden versus Syria, you would see that the Swedes, on average, work much less. What's fascinating to me, and therefore is a worthy place to put our attention, is the fact that in the last 35 to 40 years, college-educated men first, and then college-educated women have been raising their working hours. They've been working more and more and more, essentially bucking hundreds of years of economic history. Now, in trying to figure out why this might be the case, I coined this idea of workism. I said that either through their own volition and or through internalizing public policy, they have decided that the way to measure their life and the chief way to look for meaning and happiness and self-actualization in their life is not to work, earn money, and buy leisure, but rather to work and use that money to, ironically, just buy more hours of work. Mm. I think this is a pernicious idea that makes a lot of people who have worked hard enough to be happy, in fact, anxious and miserable, that a lot of college-educated parents pass on this credo of workism to their children by making them obsessed with a rugrat race of getting into the best school and pretending like this one decision by this anonymous, you know, admissions board is going to determine the rest of their life, and then also trickles up into public policy where we become allergic to the idea of passing any sort of public policy or law that might encourage people to work a little bit less. And so I, like Bridget, I think, would love to see a transformation in the way that Americans think about work that I think has to start at the top, that we have to restore a sense of non-work meaning to the top of the pedestal in our lives. And in moving work off the pedestal, hopefully that will trickle down into our laws and to the attitudes of younger generations
well, that
as well.
Seems
yeah,
to
I
be...
was going to say that's definitely what we need. We need a leisure revolution. That's what we need in this country.
Because in your book, Bridget, you write about how workplaces reward the ideal worker. That's the person who arrives first in the morning, leaves last at night, is ready to drop anything for a business trip, just go off and do it, leave the family behind. But okay, why shouldn't they be rewarded? Why shouldn't they be considered the ideal worker if they're willing to make those sacrifices? And how do you compete against people who are willing to do that if you're not?
Well, this is really where I'm spending a lot of my time kind of digging into this. How do you make that argument? Because it's a difficult one to make. It's like, if you want to make that sacrifice and be this ideal worker, you know, how can people compete with that? And I think where they can really compete, the research is becoming really clear that working that way actually doesn't give you better work. That, you know, working to the point of burnout or working beyond, you know, we are human bodies. we're not robots. Working beyond human body capacity, you end up slowing down, you make more mistakes, you burn out in the short and the long term. It leads to greater turnover. There's so much more sickness and ill health. There's some really interesting research that researchers out of Stanford and Harvard, they did a meta-analysis of all sorts of about 200 studies looking at the way we work and our work cultures and then how that leads to stress and stress-induced illness. And they've determined that the workplace, just simply the way we work and our work structures, have actually made work the fifth leading cause of death in the United States. Now, if that isn't a wake-up call to figure out how to change things, there is a real business imperative. If you really want to be competitive on the world stage, you actually need well-rested, happy, healthy, productive, positive mood workers. And we do not have the workplace cultural corporate practices. We do not have the public policy, and we do not have the mindset that's making that happen. That's what needs to change.
And it's a corporate decision to value overwork. It is an employer, a boss, who says, Tommy, you've been in the office 100 hours this week. That's fantastic. You're, you know, on a straight shot to getting partner or becoming, you know, CTO or whatever. That's an employer's decision to value that. An employer can decide to value all sorts of things. An employer can decide to value Tommy, you know, punching his coworkers who are competitors in his industry because he's really aggressive and cares a lot about that promotion. He can encourage people to sleep at the office because they're so obsessed with it. He can encourage them to forego meals and, you know, just work and work and work. All these are decisions that a boss can choose to make. The right answer is to say, wait, maybe we can change corporate culture. Maybe we can value other things. Maybe when the person's spending 70, 80, 90 hours at work, the response shouldn't be, that's fantastic, you're doing a great job, but rather, you should go home. You don't have to do this. This is not the kind of behavior that's going to make you more likely to get promoted. It's the kind of behavior that's going to make people worried that you're going to burn out and not want to do this job in 18 months, which in fact is the more likely outcome. So I think it's really important that from an employer level, people change what they value and they change the signals that they send to younger people who are just working paycheck to paycheck.
So how does that shift in balance begin? Who begins it? Does the corporation or the boss begin it, or does it begin at the employee level with young people coming in and saying, no, this isn't going to fly for me. We have to change the way you work.
Well,
I think it's
unconscionable to expect a young worker coming in and they want to succeed and conform to the culture. It's unconscionable that we're expecting them to make the change that really does, as Derek says, it needs to come from the top. And you know what I would love to see is conversations at every level in workplaces when somebody, and this happened to me a lot, you know, working in kind of workaholic newspapers over my career. People saying, oh man, I worked till 11 o'clock last night, or oh, I stayed up till 2 a.m. And instead of saying, wow, what a great worker, you turn that conversation on its head. It's like, wow, I'm so sorry you were so inefficient. What would it take to help you get your job done in the hours that you have allotted to work?
But are they being inefficient? Aren't workers being asked to do the jobs of 2 and 3 people from 10 years or 15 years ago? The 3 people would have had to do what we are now required to do because technology has made it possible.
Well, some of that, but also technology, we are not using it very well. We've sort of overlaid old systems onto new technological systems. So now you've got emails and you've got in-time meetings. And so then you end up with these crazy statistics like Bain & Company. They surveyed and all these different middle managers and came up with this statistic that the average middle manager in America, between emails and meetings and the kind of the 20-minute garbage time in between it all, basically spends 6 hours a week doing deep, concentrated, meaningful work. So yes, we can absolutely change our work systems. Our work is complicated. There is a lot of work conflict in the way that there weren't. But we are using the systems that we do have really inefficiently, and that's something that we could change pretty easily.
But where does it begin? Because on the one hand, Derek, you write that work has become our new religion. So we, as workers, employees, are devoted to this idea that I'm employed, this is my job, this is who I am, I'm going to be successful at it, and we build these behavior patterns around achieving that success on the one hand. On the other side of the coin, if you have a lot of productive workers and you're the boss or you're the head of the corporation, that means money. It's productivity equals money. So how does it begin?
It starts at the top. If work is a religion, then in this respect, equate it to Catholicism, right? There's a pope. It's a top-down structure, and there are people who control what fits in the religion and what dogma is. And the federal government can decide that it can pass certain laws that would make work balance, work-life balance easier. It can pass universal health care that wouldn't attach health care to having a job, but would make it something more like a human right. Employers can change the way they value work, not only through their laws, not only through their treatment of unions, but also just through what they tell their employees. Bridget nailed it right on the head. There's a huge difference between telling an employee, you work till 2 a.m., that's fantastic, the raise is forthcoming, and you work till 2 a.m., you don't have to do that. I'm so sorry that we made you do that. How can we fix your life so that you can be sleeping by 1:30 rather than knee-deep in email? And a lot of this has to do with establishing a culture within a company. So I have friends who do work until 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning, and have for many, many years, and they work at large companies that we all know the name of. And when I tell them, you shouldn't be sending emails at 2 a.m., you should be sleeping, what are you doing? They said, I haven't seen modeled for me an example of a successful worker at my level or a level above who can finish their work at 8 p.m. That's the problem. The problem is that no one in the little micro generations of workers that came before established a successful model of working within a 9-to-6 parameter. And you just have to. If you value both the worker and the work, both the office life and the real life, then it is incumbent upon you to establish models that allow people to maintain a piece of themselves that is not entirely soaked through with work.
And Bridget, that's something that you write about. You write about businesses that are now encouraging bosses to model behavior that encourages a stronger life outside of work, and talking about the vacations that the boss has taken, and go and take a lunch break, get out of the office at lunchtime, leave on time every day. You write about this being encouraged. Where is this being encouraged?
Well, so this is what's important, too. Role modeling from the top is really important, kind of uncovering and being honest. You know, a lot of times when people send a late-night email, they have not been working straight through. You know, they might want to pop in because something kind of crowded their brain and they want to get it out of their brain and, you know, have some sort of cognitive relief. But the signal that that sends to everyone else is like, I've just been working hours and hours. So being a little bit more honest about, you know, are you work shifting? Did you start later because you had to take a kid to the doctor, you know, being honest about how you do spend work and life, being clear about why vacation is important. And I would say one thing that corporate cultures can absolutely do is change their defaults, because sometimes changing behavior is difficult. Changing attitudes are difficult. So we need to create environments that make it easier to make these choices in this kind of workaholic culture. So for instance, there's one law firm that I write about, White & Case, and they made it a default that everyone gets paid parental leave, everybody, and that if you don't want to take it, you have to opt out of it. So men and women, people across the gender spectrum, you just automatically get it. You know, whereas in many other places, you have to ask for it. It sort of becomes a stigma. It's kind of okay if you're a woman to take it. It's not okay if you're a guy. So then that also perpetuates traditional gender roles. So you can create new defaults about make flexibility the default, make control over your time and place and manner of work a default. There are things that corporations can do tomorrow that can make a huge difference.
Both of you are successful. Both of you are busy. Both of you, I think, have multiple opportunities to work, not just in one location, because you write books. You Bridget, work at the Better Life Lab at New America. Derek, you're a freelance writer for The Atlantic, and you do all these other things as well. Have either of you found this work-life balance?
Oh, the inevitable final question.
No, that's not the final question.
Bridget, you can go first. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll just say, you know, listen, this is hard, and I'm very much a work in progress, but I'm working on it. And, you know, it's difficult to push against the status quo as a solo person. So one thing that's really important is to find, for me as a reporter and a journalist, I needed to find the data and the evidence that really kind of helped me make better decisions about work-life balance. And there's plenty of it out there, and that's what I try to write about to help people see that there's a better way to do it. And then I try to find peers that will help support that. And for instance, I've got a big magazine piece that's due. I'm really stuck on it. I was going to work on it yesterday, and instead I went hiking and out to a brewery with my husband, and it was awesome and got a better start today.
Okay. Derek?
I'm constantly looking for small, simple things that can yield big results. And to me, I haven't found anything that is more successful and efficient than scheduling. That if I tell myself, I'll get this done sometime in the next 5 days, then work and leisure over those 5 days will be leaky. While I'm watching television, I'll have my laptop open and I'll be like semi-working on this project. And then when I'm at work, I might be chatting with friends or working on my fantasy football team because I've told myself I have 5 days to finish this project. If I tell myself I have a few hours, I might finish the project, be done with the project, and be able to focus on other parts of my life. So as small and tiny and analog as it is to simply write down checklists and say, here's how I'm going to organize my time, actually being deliberate about organizing my time has then I've found the most successful way for me to reclaim the balance between work and life.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, host of the podcast Crazy Genius, and also appears frequently on both CBS News and NPR. Bridget Schulte is director of the Better Life Lab at New America and the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. We're going to be examining work-life balance through Thursday on this program. And tomorrow we examine the challenges of finding childcare, a necessary ingredient in some people's work lives, but one that often forces them to work longer and harder. And on Wednesday, we dive into paid family leave policies. On Thursday, how to find fulfillment in work, which may sound like we're giving up on ever finding that balance, but not so. Listen, you'll have to tune in to see if that's the case, I suppose. Thank you both for the hour. It was fun.
Thanks so
much. Thank you so much.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.